Now, what we're going to do today and next time is we're going to talk about effectors, the things that are turned on in response to sensory signals and internal signals. And we're going to talk today about muscle, the three different kinds, skeletal, cardiac, and smooth. And then next time, we will talk primarily about glands, which means we'll talk about hormones. Now, just in case you were worrying about it, I am very happy to see all of you. I am glad you came, but you are aware that what we do today is not on this exam, which does not mean you can forget it. It's going to come home to roost at the final, but you don't have to worry about it right away. Now, we started talking about muscle last time, and the main brunt of last time was just to convince you that smooth muscle is important. And I do want to talk, therefore, first about how it contracts before the others. But before I get to that, there's some general features I want to talk about first that all muscles have in common. And we mentioned some of those last time. And the first is that all muscles have both actin and myosin. Remember that actin is the protein that forms microfilaments. And in muscle, these are known as thin filaments. Myosin is the motor molecule of actin, and in muscle, these are called thick filaments because of the way the structure is. They actually are visibly thicker. Now, this is the way actin and myosin are arranged in striated or striped muscle, but in all muscles, you have the same setup that you have myosin lined up relative to actin. The actin is attached to something, and the actin moves in or out relative to the myosin. So in all of these cases, what happens is that the actin and the myosin slide relative to each other. Neither of them shortens. The muscle overall shortens when it contracts, but the actin and the myosin do not change in length. They only change in their position relative to each other. Now, they have another important feature. What triggers this contraction is always a rise in cytosolic calcium. Where the calcium comes from varies, but it's always the calcium. And in order to run the sliding, you have to split ATP. And in virtually all muscle membranes are electrically excitable. Now, we talked about nerve membranes being electrically excitable, having voltage-gated channels, and you can generate an action potential. You can also generate an action potential in muscle membranes. So in many cases, an action potential in a nerve, especially in skeletal muscle, triggers an action potential in the membrane of the muscle, and then the muscle contracts. Now, just one other thing that they all have in common is that when calcium triggers contraction, and using the splitting of ATP, actin and myosin move past each other, you have what is called a bridge cycle. Now, exactly how this works in non-striated muscle is not clear. But we'll talk about how it works in skeletal muscle. And something similar is going on in the others. The basic idea is that myosin has little protrusions, and myosin and actin stick together, and then you break it and they move and make another attachment, and then you break it and they move and they make another. And that's called the bridge cycle, because you make a bridge, you break it, but when you relax, you just let go and everything slides back. So we'll talk about some of the details of that in the case where it's best known. Now that pretty much summarizes the similarities, and most of today we're going to be focusing actually on the differences or doing a sort of compare and contrast between the three kinds of muscle. Now, there are pictures of muscle cells on the bottom of 20C. And if you look at those pictures, you see that we have a skeletal muscle cell, a smooth muscle cell, and a cardiac. And one of the main purposes of those pictures is to illustrate the huge difference in size. And since it's not Passover, I could bring in my favorite demonstration object. This is a skeletal muscle cell. Very large and usually long. On the other hand, here we have, by comparison, a smooth muscle cell. A smooth muscle cell is an ordinary sized cell, and it's ordinary looking. But a skeletal muscle cell, in addition to being very big, is also striped or striated, as shown in your picture. So if you ask about striated or striped, skeletal is, cardiac is, but smooth is not. Now, where do those stripes come from? Actin and myosin are always lined up relative to each other. In skeletal muscle, in all striated muscle, skeletal and cardiac, they are lined up in this sort of array, in a very regular way. And as a result, you see stripes when you look at the muscle cell. You see dark areas where the actin and the myosin overlap. And you see light areas either where there is only myosin or where there is only actin. So you see a pattern of light and dark stripes. Now, in smooth muscle, the actin and the myosin are arranged in a somewhat different way. Instead of being arranged sort of like this, so to speak, and this unit is called a sarcomere, in smooth muscle, the actin and the myosin are arranged in what are called bundles. So they look more like this. So again, the actin is the one on the end, which is attached to something. And the myosin is the stuff in the middle. And as we'll see, remember we said myosin has these little protrusions. People often write myosin sort of like a lollipop because myosin has a sort of head. And it's the head that contacts the actin when you make the bridge cycle. So you have contacts in both of these, and in both cases, the actin moves in relative to the myosin when the muscle contracts. Now, in addition to the difference in size and striped, not striped, if you look at your picture of your cardiac muscle cell, you see these are actually branched. So a cardiac muscle cell is somewhere in between in size, and it's branched, and this one sort of matches the picture on your handout. So this would be connected to another muscle cell, this would be connected to another one, this would be connected to one, and this to another. So that the muscle cell, the striated muscle cells, are all connected to each other so they can contract as a unit and your heart can act as a pump. Now, in a way, the same thing has happened in skeletal muscle. How did you get this huge thing? This formed by the fusion during development of many individual cells. So this is really a single huge multinucleate cell. And if you look at your picture, you notice there are little bumps on the top where the nuclei are. So there are many nuclei in here, and the cytoplasm equivalent of many, many cells. Now, having branched heart cells that are connected to each other, or having a single giant skeletal muscle cell, achieves that the equivalent of a whole bunch of cells will contract together. In smooth muscle, sometimes the cells are connected to each other and connect as a unit. Now, when you have either smooth or cardiac muscle cells joined to each other, they are joined with gap junctions. So maybe I should put that in here. Are there gap junctions between the cells? And the answer is no, yes, yes. Now, what's the point of a gap junction? ions can flow through a gap junction, because remember, gap junction means that there's a channel between the cells. So that means the cells are electrically coupled, and any change in polarity in one, hyperpolarization, depolarization, will be transferred to the others. Now, in the case of cardiac muscle cells, there are special connective structures at the ends. You can see that on your picture. When you look at your picture, you see that there are these sort of things that look like nipples sticking out the ends of the cell. So the cell looks sort of like this. And then this interdigitates with the next cell. And these are called intercalated discs. These are the names of the structures at the end of each branch of the cardiac muscle cell. Now, there are many gap junctions in there, and there are also desmosomes. So there are gap junctions, and there are desmosomes. Now, you may remember, or you can look up, that what desmosomes are is it means that you have proteins sticking out of the membrane which lock to each other and are anchored inside the cell to intermediate filaments. So that means these provide mechanical strength. So that between the desmosomes and the gap junctions, one cardiac muscle cell is both electrically and mechanically coupled to the next cell. Now, I have also a demo for some of this. If you consider what the end of this cell is that connects where the intercalated discs are, the end of the cell looks sort of like this. And remember, the end of the next cell looks like that too. So the two of these dimpled structures can actually fit right together. And you can sort of see here that they really make a very good seal, that you have a huge amount of contact area between the ends of the two cells all the way inside here. Now, I want to go on and talk about what this muscle actually does. Now, in your notes at this point, it says something about control of the bridge cycle, which is a sort of summary and probably should be at the end, and you can just keep it in mind. But after this, that was that, and then it had about structure. And now, what about how these things are stimulated? What is the connection like between the nervous system or the hormonal system and these muscles that allows them to contract? Now, we've already talked a bit about skeletal muscle. What controls skeletal muscle? What causes it to contract? Is it the autonomic nervous system? No. The autonomic nervous system actually controls smooth muscle and the cardiac muscle, but the somatic nervous system, that is the motor neurons, control the skeletal muscle and not the other two. And as we explained last time, a somatic neuron, a motor neuron or part of the somatic system, innervates or connects to a skeletal muscle. Now, axons are actually branched, and so these boutons or special synaptic endings, one could be on one muscle fiber and one can be on another. But we'll just concentrate on the synapse with one muscle fiber. And this synapse is very similar to a nerve-nerve synapse. Then an action potential comes down the nerve, and that's going to trigger an action potential in the muscle cell membrane. Just as a nerve releasing transmitter could generate an action potential in the next nerve cell membrane, here it's the muscle. Now, how does it do this? We know by now that when the action potential comes down to the end of the neuron, it opens voltage-gated calcium channels, and that causes exocytosis of vesicles containing neurotransmitter, and neurotransmitter is released into the synaptic cleft, where it binds to, maybe I should make my synapse a little bigger. On the postsynaptic side, there are receptors for the neurotransmitter. Now, in this particular case, where you have motor neuron or the somatic system innervating a skeletal muscle, what's the neurotransmitter? It's always acetylcholine. And is there more than one kind of receptor possible? In this system, there's only one possible receptor. Now, that's a cholinergic receptor because we're using acetylcholine, but it's the nicotinic one. So this is the nicotinic cholinergic receptor. And which kind is that? That's part of a channel itself. That thing is a channel. So it's a direct ionotropic receptor, which means that when the neurotransmitter binds the receptor is part of a channel, and the channel opens. And as we've explained many times, these are nonspecific cation channels, meaning that both sodium and potassium can move. But you should know by now that when you let both sodium and potassium move, what happens? Who does most of the moving?
Sodium.
Is sodium. So the sodium comes in and depolarizes the cell. And that, if it's over threshold, triggers an action potential. Now, the change in potential, this membrane started out just like a nerve membrane. A skeletal muscle membrane has a resting membrane potential of about minus 70 millivolts. It's about the same. The neurotransmitter from one motor neuron generates a depolarization in this membrane. And that depolarization has its own special name. This structure is called an end plate. It's a special structure found at the synapse between skeletal muscle and nerve. And if you want to go back and look at a picture, handout 18, which you don't need now, is in fact a picture of that. So when you depolarize this, it's called an end plate potential. So one action potential in the nerve generates one EPP, one end plate potential, or depolarization jolt in the muscle. Now, I think we said this last time. With a nerve, you would need many inputs to cause an action potential. But in the case of skeletal muscle, the input from one motor neuron generates an EPP, which is enough of a depolarization to open the voltage-gated channels and trigger an action potential in the muscle cell membrane. So at this point, what kind of do we have? We have a local depolarization at this point at the synapse. That triggers an action potential in the axial membrane. And that action potential is going to cause the release of calcium and contraction. So what does it take to contract this muscle? How many times do I have to fire this nerve?
Once.
Now, that's not going to get me very much contraction, but one firing will get me one measurable contraction. Now, if this were nerve, one firing would not get me a measurable action potential. It would only get me a local depolarization. Okay. Now, having said all of this, what kind of input are we talking about? We can tell a skeletal muscle to contract. Can we tell it not to? No. We cannot bother to tell it anything, and it will be relaxed. Now, we can inhibit or excite this nerve. But all this nerve can do is excite or nothing. So in terms of input, it's always positive. Either there's no input or it's positive, contract. As we will see with the other two, the input can be either plus or minus. And that's because the input is from the autonomic nervous system, which is different. Now, the only piece we ought to add here, just to complete the picture, is we said that if you do this whole shebang, action potential in nerve causes action potential in muscle. Action potential in muscle causes cytosolic calcium to go up. That causes contraction. Where does the calcium come from? It turns out that in the case of skeletal muscle, the calcium comes from the endoplasmic reticulum. The skeletal muscle stores calcium in the endoplasmic reticulum and releases it when it gets an action potential. And we'll explain how that works. Okay. How does that compare to smooth muscle? Well, that's drawn on 21A. Now, at the very bottom of 21A, if you turn it sideways, is a picture of a smooth muscle cell relaxed and contracted. And remember we talked about those bundles? So those bundles are arranged in a kind of diagonal way so that when they contract, the cell goes from the structure on the left to the one at the right. Now, you notice your picture calls these filaments, filament bundles. So these lines represent both the bundles that we were talking about of actin and myosin and also intermediate filaments also. Now, what's holding it all together? In my picture up here, I put a little dot at the end of the bundle. You noticed in your picture there are intersections of these bundles and intermediate filaments that are called dense bodies. And these are what hold the actin in place. It's equivalent to these lines at the end of a sarcomere. Now, what people often refer to the way this looks is that a smooth muscle contracted looks like a worm in a mesh bag, where you sort of tighten the mesh, and that's what you get. So this is what a smooth muscle looks like when it contracts, which is quite different than a skeletal muscle, but the underlying mechanism of the sliding actin versus myosin is essentially the same. Now, how did we trigger this? Now, we know that smooth muscle is not at the end of a motor neuron. Smooth muscle is at the end of either a neuron from the sympathetic or a neuron from the parasympathetic. And many smooth muscles get input from both. And you have drawn up here on the top a picture of some smooth muscle. Now, some smooth muscle cells operate all by themselves, but many smooth muscle cells are linked together by gap junctions, and that's the picture that you have here. There are gap junctions between these cells, so that all these smooth muscle cells are going to contract as a unit, because remember, they're electrically coupled. So this is called single unit smooth muscle. Smooth muscle comes in a continuum from one kind to the other. One extreme is what's called single unit, where everybody's linked to everybody. And then there is where they're each completely individual. And that is called multi-unit. Looks like this. to say these names seem backwards. But the reason they use these names is single unit is many parts, but they all contract together as one. Multi-unit is single individual parts, but each one contracts on its own. Each one gets its own input and contracts on its own. Now, the picture that you have there shows the end of a neuron. This would be a postganglionic neuron of either the sympathetic or the parasympathetic. Now, you don't have a special structure like a bouton at the end of a parasympathetic or a sympathetic postganglionic neuron. What am I talking about? Sympathetic and parasympathetic, you have one neuron to the ganglion and then the second postganglionic neuron going to the actual target. So at the end, here is the postganglionic or second neuron in that chain. And what it has at its end is not a specialized structure, but just a lot of little swellings. And these are labeled on your handout. They're called axon varicosities, because this is an axon. And what they have inside them are vesicles of neurotransmitter. Now, you can't tell this from the picture because it's one-dimensional, I guess, flat. But what's the orientation here? This neuron is on this axon, remember, is on the outside of the smooth muscle. And it's just resting on top of the smooth muscle. And then from these swellings, it can, by exocytosis, release neurotransmitter. Now, as this picture illustrates, a single axon or nerve ending can actually contract, or have synapses with multiple single cells of the smooth muscle. Now, what's shown in your picture is there are at least two neurons here. One of the neurons or axons is from the parasympathetic and one is from the sympathetic. So one is releasing one neurotransmitter and one is releasing the other. Or, that's usually the case. Okay. Now, it's not shown in this picture, but the same cell can actually get input from both the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. Now, in this case, each individual cell doesn't have to have input from both, and yet the unit does. Notice this is all electrically coupled. So as long as some of the cells get input from the parasympathetic and some of them get input from the sympathetic, the whole thing will get both signals. So the parasympathetic and the sympathetic often give contrasting signals, and it's the balance between the two that determines what will happen. Now, so what happens? How do you trigger a contraction in smooth muscle? One way is you have an action potential comes down the neuron. That causes exocytosis and release of neurotransmitter. That binds to receptors on the surface of the smooth muscle cell, triggers an action potential in the smooth muscle cell, and you get release of calcium and contraction. But where does the calcium come from this time? Now, these cells are very small. They don't have an extensive endoplasmic reticulum the way one of these cells does. To get calcium quickly released into the middle of this cell, you have to have calcium in the middle of this cell ready to go, because this cell is huge. So this cell has a very elaborate ER, and that releases calcium. But in these small cells, there is calcium in the ER, and some of it is released, but some of the calcium comes from outside, from opening channels in the plasma membrane. So we probably should write that over here. It comes from both the ER and the outside. And this is the same as smooth. Now, there is another issue to bring up here. Since there are two kinds of neurotransmitters here with their corresponding receptors, you can give both a relaxation signal and or a contraction signal. There is such a thing as inhibiting or blocking contraction in a smooth muscle. Now, here we're talking about neurotransmitters. But we said that norepinephrine and epinephrine have effects on these cells. And although norepinephrine is a neurotransmitter, epinephrine is actually a hormone. These cells contract not only in response to neurotransmitters, but also in response, or don't contract, in response to hormones. A chemical is a chemical as far as it's concerned. And once it binds to the receptor, it doesn't matter where it came from. So hormones, as well as neurotransmitters, bind to receptors and trigger either contraction or they block contraction in smooth muscle. So if we wanted to, we could add that. Now, you may notice this table is getting very long. You're probably flipping back and forth. If you didn't already leave a page in your notes, you probably should, because this just keeps growing. If you don't get it all now, when you get home, this is the kind of thing, okay, after the exam, this is the kind of thing that you should make for yourself and be sure that you got it straight. So another effect is, do hormones have any effect on contraction? Now, we know that hormones affect skeletal muscle. Epinephrine triggers breakdown of glycogen. But that's not contraction. Hormones do not affect contraction of skeletal muscle. The only thing that does is the input from the somatic nervous system. But hormones can affect the contraction, I'll just put a check because it can be in either direction, of smooth muscle and cardiac muscle. Now, there are two other things I should say about smooth muscle, which differentiate it from skeletal muscle. We talked about this bridge cycle business and breaking ATP, that to join the actin and myosin and then move them, you have to keep splitting ATP. It turns out with skeletal muscle, to keep contracted, you have to keep splitting ATP. But with smooth muscle, although the bridge cycle isn't known exactly, you can, in fact, apparently hold myosin attached to actin for a fairly long period without putting in any more ATP. And that's called a latch state. And this is characteristic of smooth muscle. That they can apparently maintain a semi-contracted state for longer periods without input of energy. Now, we didn't actually look at how do these muscles contract? What makes the actin and myosin get it together? And that you want to look back at your handout at 21. There's a little table there, a little diagram. Now, we have already said that in response to epinephrine, some smooth muscle contracts and some smooth muscle relaxes. And we said that had to do with which pathway we triggered. If we triggered IP3 pathway, we got contraction. And if we triggered the cyclic AMP pathway, we got relaxation. Now, this diagram sort of explains how that works. You remember we said that calcium tends to work through a binding protein called calmodulin. So cells have calmodulin. And in smooth muscle, this is important in contraction. It is not in skeletal or other striated muscle. But in smooth muscle, you have to calmodulum has to bind calcium in order for contraction to occur. So when calcium is generated, that is, when calcium is either released from the ER or comes in through open channels in the plasma membrane, the calmodulin then binds that calcium and you get a complex, which I'll just write complex. Now, in the complex, the calmodulin has a different conformation, and it in turn now, the complex, binds a kinase. So that's called myosin light chain kinase. And the complex binds to it. It by itself, the kinase, is inactive. But when the kinase binds with the complex, so now you have kinase, and bound to it is calcium bound to calmodulin. So you have a calmodulin kinase complex, all triggered by the binding of calcium. This is active. So in both of these cases, we've just had a change in conformation. By binding calcium, the calmodulin changed shape. That allowed it to stick to the kinase, and the kinase changed shape. So these are all changes in conformation. But now we get a covalent difference. The kinase works. So what do kinases do? They add phosphate to things from ATP. So this is where one of the ways you need ATP. You need it to convert inactive myosin, which does not stick to actin, into sticky or active myosin. You actually, by adding the phosphate, because this requires ATP, as shown here, phosphorylated myosin basically unfolds, its head sticks up, and it's ready to stick to actin. And now you can trigger one of those bridge cycles where the myosin sticks to the actin, pushes the actin, breaks, and does it again. So why do you need ATP for this muscle to move? First you need ATP to juice up the myosin. And then you need more ATP to run the bridge cycle, whose exact details we're not going into. So you need ATP at both places. I have a question. If you want to inactivate the myosin, what do you need? You have to take the phosphate off, because it's actually been covalently modified. So you're actually going to need another enzyme, a phosphatase, to in fact inactivate the myosin and get the muscle to relax. Now, what does this have to do with epinephrine, cyclic AMP, IP3? What does IP3 do? The most famous action of IP3 is to release calcium from the ER. So if you trigger the IP3 pathway, the calcium in the cytosol is going to go up. Calmodulin is going to be activated. It's going to activate the kinase, which is going to phosphorylate the myosin. And now you can enter the bridge cycle and contraction is possible. Now, why should the cyclic AMP have the opposite effect? Well, it turns out that this inactive kinase can be phosphorylated by another kinase, which is pKa. This business of kinases phosphorylating kinases turns out to be extremely common. There is a very famous case of three in a row, which are called, something kinase, something, something, something kinase, kinase, and something kinase, kinase, kinase. They have other names, as you may imagine. So in this case, protein kinase A adds phosphate to the kinase for myosin and inactivates it permanently. Well, for the time being. Well, if it's inactive and you can't bind calmodulin, that's the critical part. The phosphorylated version of pKa, not pKa, MLCK, myosin kinase with a phosphate cannot bind calmodulin. So if the cyclic, what does it have to do with cyclic AMP? Cyclic AMP activates protein kinase A. Protein kinase A phosphorylates the kinase, which can no longer phosphorylate myosin. What determines whether a given muscle will cause whether epinephrine on a given muscle will give you contraction or relaxation? Well, it depends which of these you trigger, right? Well, epinephrine is epinephrine. So what determines which of these you kick in? What do you think?
Pathway.
Well, what part of the pathway?
Whether it comes from sympathetic neuron or...
Well, the question is where the epinephrine comes from. But the truth here is that epinephrine itself actually is a hormone. It's something about somewhere in the line, but the question is where. What do you think?
G protein?
Well, you have two different G proteins. One G protein actually, what would it have to activate to do this? You'd have to activate adenyl cyclase to get cyclic AMP. What would you activate to get IP3?
PLC.
It would be PLC. So there are two different G proteins. So what determines which G protein you kick in? It's the receptor. So in fact, if smooth muscle has receptors for that activate the appropriate G protein, you get this one. If it has a different receptor that activates the other G protein, you get this one. Okay. Now, the only other important... What's the question?
Doesn't that defeat the purpose of the two different systems, sympathetic and parasympathetic?
Doesn't this defeat the sympathetic and the business of the opposing... Okay. The argument is that in response to either epinephrine or norepinephrine, in other words, a crisis, should all of your smooth muscle contract or relax? And the answer is no. Some of your smooth muscle should contract, and some of your smooth muscle should relax. And so it's appropriate that different smooth muscles have different receptors and respond differently to the same signal. Yeah?
Why is it in smooth muscle that the calcium comes from the outside?
Say that again? You thought in smooth muscle calcium comes from the outside. The opinion seems to be that in smooth muscle it comes from both the outside and from the ER, and the proportions differ depending on the smooth muscle type and probably the conditions. Remember that it doesn't... This doesn't mean that when a muscle contracts, sometimes a lot of the calcium comes from the outside. But we're saying IP3 is capable of triggering enough calcium release from the ER to trigger this also. Yes, what was the question here?
So in the beginning it said that smooth muscles respond without generating an AP.
Some smooth muscles can respond without generating an AP, and I have deliberately avoided that. Okay, it works by opening channels directly. Yeah?
In your picture of the skeletal muscle, you had the EPP arrows going up and down. So does the depolarization
in this picture, the EPP, the local depolarization, is only going to be here.
Okay.
But as a result, you're going to trigger, here's your synapse, you're going to trigger action potentials in all directions from there because there are voltage-gated channels out here. Yeah.
Are you familiar with any muscle disorders that are related to calcium, that like if there's not enough calcium in the ER or just related to what happens?
I don't know all the... He asked about muscle disorders. I don't know about them on the top of my head, but just about anything you can think of happens. But you have to realize that a lot of these things would be lethal, and therefore the only cases you find of them are new mutations. Things that only make a little bit of difference, well, not such a big deal. Yeah? Where is the action potential? There is this special end plate structure here, and it doesn't have voltage-gated channels, but the rest of the muscle does. So wherever the voltage-gated channels begin, which will be nearby, you will begin the action potential. Okay. Now, we've talked a lot about smooth muscle, and there's one piece that I didn't mention, that some smooth muscle can contract without input. And And even though it contracts without input, input of hormones and neurotransmitters makes it contract faster or slower. And why is that? That is because of what are called pacemaker cells. Some smooth muscles have pacemaker cells, and heart or cardiac muscle has pacemaker cells. Now, this doesn't mean that every heart cell is a pacemaker cell. This means that a small number of the cells in the heart and a small number of the cells in some muscle, some smooth muscle, have pacemaker properties. These are cells that fire action potentials by themselves without input, and they set a standard rhythm. Now, input, additional input from hormones and neurotransmitters can change that rhythm. They can make it faster or slower, but the thing contracts by itself. Now, you all already know a case of this. You may remember the Lowy experiment that Dr. Feierstein talked about. If you think about it, it's a little bit gruesome. They took out a frog heart and they put it in a beaker, and the frog heart continued to beat. Hearts have pacemaker cells, and as a result, a heart by itself, without any nerve input, will in fact beat. But what innervates a heart? Hearts don't operate without nerves. It is the automatic nervous system that in fact sends nerves to the heart. Both the parasympathetic and the sympathetic send nerves to the heart, and they release neurotransmitters. That was shown by the Lowy experiment, that the vagus nerve releases, in fact, acetylcholine. Now, what these neurotransmitters to the heart do is they don't directly cause contractions. What they do is change the rhythm of the pacemaker cells. Now, both, what I want to talk about now is how pacemaker cells work, because they're important both in heart muscle, which in many ways works like skeletal muscle, and they're important in certain smooth muscles. So how does a pacemaker cell work? For this, I think you want to look at the last handout at C. In the picture on the bottom right. We're used to thinking of a cell as having a stable resting membrane potential. So this is millivolts, this is volts, millivolts. This is the membrane potential, and this is time. And in an ordinary neuron or muscle cell membrane, the cell's membrane is at the resting membrane potential, and then you open some channels and you get a little depolarization, and you go over threshold and you generate an action potential. That's our standard picture. But you notice the picture in the lower right looks quite different. This is what you see in a pacemaker cell. It doesn't have a stable resting membrane potential. At the end of an action potential, it repolarizes, and then it depolarizes spontaneously until it hits threshold, and then it fires an action potential, and then it comes back to where it was. It repolarizes, and then it gradually depolarizes to hit threshold, and then it generates another action potential. So this is called a pacemaker potential. It's a kind of unstable resting membrane potential. And then this is your standard action potential. First a depolarization, then a hyperpolarization. Now, what this means is since this cell depolarizes all by itself, it will eventually hit threshold and fire, even if it gets no input at all. And the question is, what could allow it to do that? How does something depolarize? I could put it another way. If these two cells have exactly the same ion channels, would this work? And the answer is no. This cell has ion channels that do not open to allow depolarization unless you trigger them. Depending on what the cell is, usually chemically, you need a neurotransmitter which will allow sodium to come in. You have a ligand-gated channel, and when you open it enough, you hit threshold, and you open the voltage-gated channels. What opens these channels? There must be some channels here that open gradually all by themselves. Are these ligand-gated? Well, this cell is doing this all by itself. No neurotransmitter, no hormone. So they can't be ligand-gated. Are they mechanically gated? Well, there's no light, there's no heat, there's nobody pushing this cell around, so presumably not. So what opens them? Well, you could say they open by themselves, but the usual answer is they're voltage-gated. Now, the usual voltage-gated channel opens when? When you go that way, when you depolarize enough. But what opens these channels is when you hyperpolarize. When you hit a very low resting membrane potential, that starts opening these channels. So these are often called funny channels because they act peculiar. We're not going to go into exactly what kind they are. But what's going on here? The cell is becoming depolarized, so primarily it's thought that more sodium is coming in, although some people think less potassium is going out. But the net effect is that ions come in, you reach threshold, you fire an action potential. Now, this is what a pacemaker cell's rhythm looks like, or its polarization across the membrane. Now, heart pacemaker cells do this by themselves. So do some smooth muscle cells. How can acetylcholine or norepinephrine change this? We know that norepinephrine makes your heart beat faster. Acetylcholine makes it beat slower. So you must be changing this interval, the time it takes to reach threshold and fire. These channels can be inhibited so they open slower, and then the cell will depolarize slower, and it will take longer to reach threshold. Or these channels can be induced to open faster, in which case you depolarize faster, and you reach threshold faster, and you get more beats per second. So what the neurotransmitters do here is the neurotransmitters affect the opening of the channels or closing of the channels responsible for this depolarization, thereby changing the rhythm of the pacemaker. And that, in turn, changes the rhythm of the heart contraction or the smooth muscle contraction. So in many cases, you can think of, like with the heart or with smooth muscle, you have a mixture of contractile cells, sort of your ordinary muscle cells, and a few of these pacemaker cells. And what the chemical signals do is control the pacemaker cell, right? And that controls the rest of the cells. Because all the cells are connected by gap junctions, so if you fire up one, it fires the next. Now, I think I have said pretty much what I want to say about smooth muscle for now and cardiac muscle for now. And I want to talk a bit about skeletal muscle. How does skeletal muscle contract? So you want to look now back at A for today. People are very fond of talking about skeletal muscle because it's one of the few cases where we understand what's going on from the ionic and molecular level all the way up to the gross anatomy level. But we're going to skip some of the steps because enough is enough already. And what I want to consider, Billy, is this bridge cycle. How do the actin and myosin work relative to each other, and how do you get the calcium to trigger it off? Now, to come back to our skeletal muscle cell, this, remember, is a multinucleate cell. It's formed by the fusion of many cells. And within this cell, there are so-called myofibrils. And each myofibril contains actin and myosin aligned in this regular sarcomere setup. Now, I think the best analogy for this is that good is not passive. That a muscle cell looks sort of like this. It is packed with these rods, and each rod is actin and myosin properly aligned. And you can fish out one of these if you want, so to speak. This is a so-called myofibril, and it will be striped, just like the whole muscle is, because of the regular arrangement of actin and myosin. And the actin and myosin is arranged in this sort of way. As we mentioned earlier, the light sections refer to where there's only myosin or only actin. The dark is where they overlap. And when the muscle contracts, the dark areas get larger and the small light areas get smaller. Now, the only structure we want to talk about here is that this structure at the end is known as the Z-line. And when muscles contract, the Z-lines get closer together, just like with our little model sarcomere here. So this would be the Z-lines on the yellows on the end. And so when the muscle contracts, the Z-lines get closer. And when it relaxes, they get further apart. We're not going to worry about all the other various stripes here. Now, we have mentioned that myosin has these little heads. One of the reasons myosin is referred to as the thick fibers is that there are many such heads on a myosin, usually just on the end, not in the middle, so that the overall fiber is much bigger than fibrous actin, which, remember, is two globular chains twisted around each other. So what's going to happen is that when calcium is released, the myosin and the actin are going to slide. And they do that in what is called a so-called bridge cycle. And that's on handout B, and that's what I want to go over next. Now, before I erase this, it's important to realize that when we were talking about smooth muscle, who got modified so I could get the myosin and the actin together? You notice I had to modify the myosin, and now it is ready to contact the actin. In skeletal muscle, it is the other way around. The actin is covered up. The myosin is ready to go, but the actin is covered up, and I have to uncover the actin so I can get the myosin in there. So the cycle is a little bit different. And there are no covalent modifications involved in the bridge cycle in skeletal muscle. Now, this is a cycle, but we're going to start by taking it from the top, so to speak. And in the picture we have here, here is one myosin head. Now, of course, there are many. And here is one actin. Now, on actin, there are multiple potential spots where myosin can connect. So I've written them here as one, the way I drew it, two, three, four. They should be at equal distances if I drew it right. So to start, myosin is under two. Now, what is going to happen? And don't worry about the numbers. I'll explain why we didn't start at the beginning in a minute. What's going to happen first in this picture, what we've called step four, is we're going to basically convert myosin to what is called its high energy state. Sort of like you have a rubber band or a spring and you pull it back or cock it. So this is the high energy or the cocked form. And notice it's now under number three. It used to be under number two. Now, the next step, so this is step four, and we went from step A to step B. And now, in the step that's labeled one, because that's where it normally starts when a muscle contracts, We're going to go to step C. And you notice what's the difference. In step C, all that's happened is the myosin has actually attached to the actin. This is a non-covalent attachment. It's a binding of two proteins. Now, so we attach in step 1. And now in step C, they're attached to each other. But now, remember, this is the high-energy form of myosin. It's like a stretched rubber band, and we let it loose. So if we let it go, it's going to straighten up. And if the myosin straightens up, it's going to push the actin to the left. So now, in stage D, the myosin is upright again. It's still attached, but it's upright, and it's under 2. It's under 3, 2, 1. So you notice that the actin has been pushed relative to the myosin. But they're still stuck together. So in order to run the cycle again, we have to detach the actin from the myosin. And under normal circumstances, skeletal muscle has no latch state. It is not possible to remain in this state. This has to be broken. And if the muscle's going to stay contracted, it's just going to do it again. And so the next stage is to detach. So now we have to detach. So here we straighten out. Straighten out. In step 2. In step 3, we detach. Yes. But now, if we detach it, you may notice that this looks exactly the same as our first picture, except we move the myosin over one relative to the actin, or the actin over one relative to the myosin, depending on how you look at it. So this is actually a cycle. So in step 4, what we do is cock the myosin again. Now, what does it take to do these things? Although this is triggered by calcium, this cycle requires ATP. So we could put either one in first, but I think I'm going to put the ATP in first. Because it turns out, cells normally do not run out of ATP. The only time you run out of ATP is when you're dead. So cells generally have plenty of ATP, and in fact the problem is to stop this when you don't want to contract, because it's not the ATP that's going to run out, it's going to be something else, and it's the calcium that takes care of that. So you have plenty of ATP, what's going to happen? What do you need ATP for? It turns out you need ATP to detach, to take the myosin apart from the actin. So this requires ATP, step 3. Now, it doesn't require that you split ATP, only that ATP bind. And it basically binds to the myosin, but the point is that you need to bind ATP. Now, why is that significant? I just said you run out of ATP when you're dead. Surprise. So you run out of ATP, where are you going to get stuck? You're going to get stuck right here with your actin locked to your myosin. And that's the basis of rigor mortis. Now, what happens after a while is the muscles begin to fall apart and you lose it. But in the short run, the real reason that your people get stiff when they're dead, should never happen to any of us, is because the myosin and the actin are locked. But normally that doesn't happen to you. You have plenty of ATP. So you bind ATP and that takes apart the actin and the myosin. And then you have to split the ATP to hydrolyze it in order to get the energy to cock the myosin. Now both parts remain bound. And it's important to realize which half of this has the ATP splitting activity. Is it the actin or the myosin? Myosin is the motor molecule. Myosin is responsible for movement. And it's the myosin that by itself splits ATP. Myosin is said to be an ATPase, while actin has no ATPase activity. So we split the ATP, but both the ADP and the PI are still there. Now, in the next two steps, first you lose the PI, and then you lose the ADP. So you split ATP, but it's still there. So we'll write ADP and PI bound. And now, in the absence of calcium, that's where you stop. So I could write it either low calcium blocks this, or I could say you require calcium to do step one. No calcium, no step one. But let's suppose we have calcium. So if we have calcium, then what will happen is that the myosin will attach to the actin, and in this step it will attach. And in order to attach, it will lose the inorganic phosphate. So the myosin still has ADP, but not PI anymore. And then when it straightens up, and this is often called the power stroke, when it straightens up, somewhere around here, you lose the ADP. So by this stage, attached, you could say this is sort of like at the end, attached, no ADP, no PI, no nothing. And now we have to add ATP to start over. So you have to bind ATP, split ATP, straighten up and lose PI, attach and lose PI, and then straighten up and lose ADP, and then start over again. Now, why would calcium have anything to do with any of these? Well, if you look at actin closely, you see that actin is associated with two other proteins that are complex together that are called troponin and tropomyosin. There are pictures of these in your books and on the web. Now, what happens is that in the absence of calcium, this complex covers up the binding sites on actin. When calcium comes along, it binds to this complex and changes its conformation so it bends away. And you expose, so you cover this, and then calcium allows you to uncover. Calcium basically causes a change in the conformation of the troponin-tropomyosin complex, allowing you to uncover the actin so the myosin can stick to it. So in smooth muscle, these two can't get it together because the myosin is all folded up and has to be phosphorylated. In skeletal muscle, these two can't get it together because the actin is covered up. And you have to have calcium to push the proteins out of the way. And striated muscle is the same. I mean, all striated muscle, including heart, is the same in that respect. So before I discuss where the calcium comes from, are there any questions about this? Yeah?
Just as far as the cyclical nature, it looks like the action is moving more and more in the same direction as it comes back.
Okay. So what is happening is, he's correct, that we're moving in this direction. We're moving both of these in. To relax, you basically break all of the connections and the actin slides back. Well, remember, what's happening here is that you have many, many myosin heads stuck to actin. And at any one time, one of them is breaking, reforming. If all of them are on the average moving in, one thing happens. If all of them are letting go, on the average, something else happens. Okay. Yeah.
What's so special about the active sites on the actin? Like, why are they...
What's so special about the active sites on the actin? What makes any two proteins stick together? They have some kind of weak interaction complementarity. Yeah?
So the reason why they don't slide apart, like kind of fall apart, the actin and the myosin filaments, is because of the stretch response, and that your muscle, skeletal muscle, is going to contract when your muscle stretches?
Well, the question is, why doesn't the actin and myosin fall apart when your muscle relaxes? There are other proteins in this picture that hold everything together, like there's one here that we haven't drawn in. Yeah, one more. Yeah.
Is the Z line a protein?
The two Z lines would get closer together when the muscle contracts.
No, but are the proteins that...
They made a protein, yes. There are many multiple proteins in here besides actin and myosin. And they hold it together and they make up the Z line, etc. And we have ignored them. Okay. Now, where does the calcium come from this time? It comes from the ER. Now, remember the term sarc is used a lot for muscles. So in muscle, the ER is called the sarcoplasmic reticulum, or the SR. The cytosol is called the sarcoplasm instead of the cytoplasm. The unit is called the sarcomere. You get the picture. So inside our big fat skeletal muscle, the ER is inside. It is around and between all of the breadsticks. Now, the question is, how does an action potential on the outside of the membrane trigger a release of the calcium inside the ER? And the answer is something which is called a T-tubule. And one more demonstration here. So this is the surface of the cell membrane. You have indentations in the surface of the membrane that are more or less equivalent to what you would get if you took one of these and you just pushed it in. So what's sticking into the cell is something like that. So this extension of the membrane, when there's an action potential around the membrane, the action potential goes all the way down here into the middle of the cell. And these are next to the ER, aka SR, sarcoplasmic reticulum. So these are right next to each other, even though it isn't at all obvious why that should be so. And since these protrusions or T-tubules have areas which are next to the ER, when the action potential comes down, it triggers opening of channels in the ER, and calcium is released to the ER. And something very similar happens in heart, although the exact details of how the action potential causes the channels to open is a little different in heart and in skeletal muscle. Now, there's one more thing on these handouts, which I think we'll mention very briefly and maybe wrap up next time. And that is the issue of what happens if you fire multiple action potentials. Every time I fire an action potential in the nerve, I get an action potential in my skeletal muscle. Well, what happens is, if you look at the last page of your handout on C, each time you fire an action potential in the muscle membrane, here's an action potential. This is the top left picture. This is an action potential, but this is in the muscle membrane, not in the nerve. So you fire an action potential, and each time you do that in the muscle, it causes a small contraction called a twitch. And the twitch timing, the actual amount of contraction is small, but a twitch takes a long time. Now, so I fire the neuron, I fire the action potential in the muscle twitches. Now can I fire another action potential? At this point, the refractory period is over and I can fire another action potential. And at this point, I could fire another one, and then I could fire another one, and then I could fire another one. What would happen if I kept firing the neuron, which kept firing the action potential in the muscle? The muscle would contract a little bit, and before it could begin to relax, it would have to contract again. And it would contract more and more and more and more. And that gives you the picture next to this one on the right. that the muscle twitches, as they say, are summed. So if you have action potential, another action potential, another action potential, the contraction of the muscle would look like this. Until finally it gets maximally contracted. You can't contract it anymore. And it continues to make and break bridges, but it doesn't get any shorter, because it's as short as it can get. And this state is known as tetanus, which just means as tight as you can get. Does your heart muscle do that? If you keep stimulating your heart muscle, does it beat faster and faster and faster and faster and faster? No, it doesn't. Now the question is, in other words, why doesn't your heart muscle ever get maximally contracted and just stay there? Well, it doesn't. Why not? And that's the picture underneath that explains why that doesn't happen. That if you look at an action potential in a heart muscle membrane, it looks like the picture on the far right. It looks like this. This, believe it or not, is an action potential. But this is an action potential in the heart muscle membrane. Now, your heart can beat faster because, up to a point, because the chemical signals make the neurotransmitters released, or hormones, which makes the pacemakers depolarize faster, which makes your heart beat faster. But it never gets into a permanently locked state. And the reason for that is the action potential is too long. So when is the refractory period over? It's not over till here. And a twitch is about the same. So if you look at the bottom left picture, you notice that the length of a twitch and the length of an action potential in heart are about the same. So if I try and fire an action potential here, what happens? Nothing. Even if I stimulate at this point, the voltage-gated sodium channels are locked shut. They are in their refractory period, and they won't do anything. I can't trigger another contraction until here, when the first one is over. Now, I have only one more question for you. How is it possible to get an action potential that looks like that? Instead of looking like that. Obviously, what happens is the cell depolarizes, but it remains depolarized. And without going into the details, it must mean that a cell that has this kind of action potential and a cell that has this kind of action potential don't have the same channels. They have different channels so that we're able to keep them open and keep this cell depolarized longer. So twitches some in skeletal muscle, but they do not sum in heart muscle. So your heart muscle never gets locked in tetanus. Now what we're going to do next time, it was going to talk a very little bit about the heart and circulation, probably mostly just circulation, and then we're going to talk about glands and hormones, how they are triggered to be released and controlled.